this family, they grew up really country. There wasn't a basketball goal out there in the country. You know, you grow up in the country, you invent your own fun.
Wright Thompson is a senior writer for ESPN. He's been reporting on the history of Michael Jordan's family.
Mike used to ride horses around the land up until one of them threw him off. And instead of just falling off the horse, which hurts bad enough, his foot gets caught in the stirrup. And then for like a quarter of a mile, the horse is dragging him through all of this tilled ground, ripping through the stalks. One time when he was like, I don't know, 7 or 8, he and his brothers thought it'd be fun if they jumped over the electric fence into the hog pen and just annoyed the pigs, you know, made them chase them and run around in the mud. So Michael's in there, and then the pig gets really mad and he realizes, you know, I need to get out of here. And so he turns and starts running for the fence. Now he's Michael Air Jordan, so he's going to jump over the fence. But this was many, many years before the free throw line dunk. So he just misjudged it. And he just caught the electric fence right in the chest. And I don't know if you've ever, I mean, electric fences hurt. And so, you know, he goes in the house, he's covered in mud, he's been shocked, and he's looking for a little sympathy. And his parents were just like, you shouldn't have been messing with that pig. So Michael grew up country tough.
Over the 10 episodes of The Last Dance, we've seen the dominance of Michael Jeffrey Jordan on full display. Now, with the docuseries complete, we explore how he became the man we saw. Wright Thompson takes us back to Jordan's childhood and traces the roots of his unbreakable will. Today, the story of a family and a place that gave rise to greatness. I'm Mina Kimes. It's Monday, May 18th. This is ESPN Daily, presented by Marathon. Right, it's been, I think, 7 years since you profiled. Wow. So seven years ago, you profiled Michael Jordan for ESPN, the magazine. And it's a fantastic story, but it was at a time when, you know, he didn't do interviews, really. We weren't getting to see him or hear from him. And now, over the last few weeks, he's been everywhere. What's it been like for you seeing present tense Michael Jordan for all the world to see?
I've really enjoyed it. I've watched every minute of it. You can't really turn away. I mean, for the finale yesterday, I ordered Chicago dogs from Vienna Beef with like the poppy seed buns and the sport peppers and the celery salt and the whole deal.
Well, over the last few weeks, we've watched MJ's career documented and that final season, of course, but it's been primarily Jordan as an adult. You decided to bookend this series for us by focusing on his early life, what's really not shown in the documentary before he became a basketball player, much less a basketball star. And you also wanted to tell his family story. Why did you focus on that?
As I watched it, and you just saw this relentless competitiveness, I believe Michael calls it a will to prove, a unearthly work ethic. I mean, you know, the thing starts hitting all these notes over and over and over again. My editor, Eric Neal, and I really started talking like, what did we just see? Where did it come from? And what does it mean? I just started researching the part of North Carolina where Michael came from and piece by piece, his own family history emerged, and in a way that I think both adds something to the documentary that just wrapped, but also just adds to people's understanding of how that person who was just on their screen for 10 hours got to be like that.
We see a little bit of his childhood in the documentary. We know he grew up in North Carolina. What was his upbringing like?
I mean, he grew up real country, and he lived in Wilmington. His grandparents lived out in the country. His people come from out in the country, playing in the woods, shooting BB guns at his brother, which I, you know, I could relate to that. He grew up with that kind of life and surrounded by family members, multiple generations of family members. I mean, he knew his great-grandfather, Dawson, who was the son of a slave. You know, he had access to both life experience and to other people's life experience that really shaped him.
Right. You traced the Jordan family tree in North Carolina. And if you go five generations of men back from Michael, you get to John Jordan. Who is he?
John Jordan was born a slave in North Carolina, as was his son, Richard, who was born in, I think, 1862, I believe. Everyone is pretty sure that John was a slave on the Stag Park plantation, and the owners of the plantation were Jesse and Mary Elizabeth Jordan. Their descendants, who I talked to, confirmed that story. And so John and Alice had a son named Richard, who had a son named Dawson, who had a son named William, who had a son named James, who had a son named Michael.
How does that strike you, looking back into the roots of the Jordan name, seeing where it comes from and knowing what it's become, the global brand that it's become?
That he carries those people with him. He took all those people with him when he left there, when he went to Chicago, and when he became Michael Jordan. This is the Jordan story. It belongs to Michael and James and William and Dawson and Richard and John and Dolores Jordan and Michael's brothers and sisters. And, you know, I had a real palpable sense of just be the custodian of it briefly.
So you set out to put together Michael Jordan's family tree, but also to get a sense of place. What did you learn about where the family lived and how that influenced them?
They lived on Gordon Road there in Wilmington, right by Highway 117. And so for the past five or six generations, the Jordans have lived in between that road and two real big swamps there. These are old, you know, Tupelo cypress tree swamps and 800-year-old longleaf pines and bears back in there and big deer, like huge Boone and Crockett deer with big racks and songbirds and wild turkeys. And I mean, you know, his great-grandfather, Dawson, you know, worked at a hunting camp back in one of those swamps.
What did you find when you started researching Wilmington, North Carolina?
I mean, Wilmington, first of all, I mean, I didn't really realize this. In 1898, Wilmington was a model for what a U.S. city might be. It was called the most integrated city in the country and the most integrated city in the South. It had the highest African-American population of any city in the South at 60%. There were Black elected officials. There were liberal white elected officials who were taking the town in a direction that the establishment didn't like. And in 1898, after losing an election, the day after the election, they put on red shirts. They called themselves the Red Shirts and killed a bunch of folks and ran African-American politicians and middle-class business leaders out of town, ran liberal white folks out of town. And basically, it was a coup. And now I think 17% of Wilmington is African-American as opposed to 60. Being from Wilmington and especially from the country outskirts of Wilmington is a really freighted idea that people don't often consider when they're looking at Michael Jordan. There's this myth that Michael Jordan is post-racial, and I just don't think that stands up to scrutiny. There's a bit in the story where, you know, he and his friend, when they were probably 12 years old, went over to a neighbor's house to swim and were, you know, splashing around in the pool like kids do. And his friend's parents get home and see these kids in the pool and see Michael Jordan in the pool and tell everybody to get out of the pool, no more swimming. And so Michael and his friend leave to walk away, and they're outside and they hear all the other white kids jump back in the pool. Those are the things that he doesn't really talk about much, but they stick with him.
Did you get a sense through your reporting and talking to people that those experiences, the experiences of his family or the ones, as you just described, he grew up with, impacted him back then when he was young?
I think absolutely. I mean, he has talked about how when he was in ninth grade, Roots came out and he was, you know, was really upset.
During that time, I was very, very angry because I was learning about the history of what happened to us. And that's what Roots did to me. And I started to retaliate in school. And it took my mother to come to me and tell me, it's a history, it's something that you should never forget, but you can rise above it and make an impact and make a change and make people aware of some of the pain that we've endured.
And the next year is the year he supposedly got, well, I mean, technically, I guess, got cut from his high school basketball team. And that is where Michael Jordan was born.
Tell us what you mean when you say he supposedly got cut.
There's a fabulous Sports Illustrated story that everyone should read by Thomas Lake that did the first and best and most comprehensive work on the subject. And basically, it wasn't like the coach just didn't think Michael was talented. He thought Michael was too talented to ride the bench. So basically what he did was he put him on the JV team where he could get a ton of minutes because he just thought, this is a really great player who could be really great, and he needs to be somewhere where he's having reps. So the idea that he was sort of shunned and cut, I'm certain Michael believes it. But when you start actually scratching, it becomes a little more complicated than that.
Why are you certain he believes it?
I mean, you hear him talk about it.
And then there's Leroy Smith. He started the whole process with me because when he made the team and I didn't, I wanted to prove not just to Leroy Smith, not just to myself, but to the coach who actually picked Leroy over me. I wanted to make sure you understood you made a mistake, dude.
That's not someone who's lying. That's someone who has carefully over many, many years built a universe that allows him to be Michael Jordan. And that requires certain laws of physics. And the main one is, you know, thou shalt prove doubters wrong.
What was it like for him when he showed up in Chicago, which was by far the biggest city he'd ever lived in?
September 28th, 1984, I think. I mean, he was wide-eyed and scared to death, or what his friends told me. You know, it's funny. You've seen him on the dock, George Kohler. George is Michael's, you know, he's like Turtle. He's just always there. He's Michael's driver. He's one of his best friends. He's his assistant. George does everything. And so George drove a limo, and Michael shows up, and the Bulls evidently forgot to send someone to pick him up. And so he's just standing out there, just as George said, scared to death, and no one is there to get him. And George sort of rolls the window down. It's like, you need a ride? Are you Michael Jordan? And Michael was like, I do need a ride. And that was, I don't know, my God, that was 36 years ago. And George is still there.
Wow. When he showed up in the documentary, I was wondering, where did he come from?
That's where he came from. I mean, he was the first person Michael ever met in Chicago, and he's still there. I mean, Michael's loyalty is something that, I mean, gets discussed, but I mean, I don't think people realize the degree to which, like, if you're in his tribe, you're in his tribe for life.
All right, after the break, let's talk about how Michael Jordan's upbringing shaped his life as a star. We're presented by Marathon. Now, more than ever, we have to look out for each other and count on each other. And Marathon wants you to know that you can count on them for high-quality, top-tier gas. While we are aware travel might not be top of mind, there might be times where you have to hop in the car to run an errand. Maybe you have to drop off groceries and supplies to your family. Maybe you've become an amazing baker and want to drop off a few dozen cookies on your best friend's porch. Or maybe you just want to drive around to all of your friends' homes simply to wave from a safe distance. But before you head out, remember to fuel up at Marathon. Marathon gasolines are formulated with STP additives. They keep your vehicle running at peak performance by optimizing fuel economy, removing those ugly deposit buildups, and reducing emissions. Remember, wherever you need to go, the people at Marathon are behind you all the way. Marathon, fueling the American spirit. We've seen his family, glimpses of them. His father, of course, passed away. His mother has been interviewed for the documentary. But I was wondering, in your reporting, not just asking, you know, them about Jordan, but inquiring into who they were, what did you find?
I found that they were, look, this sounds like a cliche, but I mean, they were a family with a very strong religious background. They were a family with a very fierce independent streak. I talked to Roy Williams, the basketball coach at the University of North Carolina, and, you know, he started his career. He was one of the people who recruited Michael Jordan, or Mike Jordan, as he was known then. And he was driving from Chapel Hill to Wilmington to play golf and just decides, oh, hell, I'm going to go over to Gordon Road. And he went over to that house and just remembered and let those memories wash over him. And one of the images in his head was of James Jordan out there working on something in the driveway. I mean, James Jordan put a car up on blocks. James Jordan could build a wooden stove. As Michael told me, if he didn't know how to do it, he'd read a book. When Michael was with the Bulls, his pipes froze, I think, and burst in his condo. And his dad was like, don't pay somebody to fix that. I could fix it. And so James Jordan just goes up to Chicago and he fixes his pipes. This is the thing they grew up with, right? Michael's mother wrote children's books after he got famous. In one of them, her parenting philosophy was laid bare. Saying you want something is fine and well, a good start, but doing something about it is what really counts. At the end of that book, when the mother puts her son to bed after his first successful basketball game, she tells him with pride, I guess you aren't just a dreamer, but a doer, Michael. And I think what James and Dolores clearly taught was to dream and to do, and that one without the other is nothing at all. All of the Jordan kids, there are five of them, you could tell that James and Dolores Jordan did a hell of a job because, I mean, all those kids are something, not just the famous one.
It sounds like the sense you got wasn't just that he held on to North Carolina or his parents, but that they informed everything he did.
I mean, the good and the bad, and understanding that there are both, and that it was shaped, that it shaped you. I mean, you know, Imani Perry is a professor at Princeton, who's just one of the smartest Americans there is. And, you know, one of the things she said to me, I just pulled it up, was, you know, talking about, you know, Michael's unrelenting work ethic. She says it is political. There is a transcendence of the expectations of what space you're going to occupy. And, you know, Republicans buy sneakers, but whose sneakers are they buying? Who is the person who all of these kids want to be like, you know, want to be like Mike? I mean, Imani, here's what you said about that. This is so interesting. That was a significant transformation to have the entire nation say they want to be like a black man from rural North Carolina. I mean, I found that really, really smart and sort of mind expanding as a way of thinking about how Jordan exists in the culture.
We were talking about how one of the interesting things in watching the whole documentary from start to finish is sort of the softening of Jordan's accent as he grows older. And you see that, right? And it's condensed. But to me, it's such a stark reminder of what you're describing, which is where he came from.
Well, and, you know, we all lose our Southern accent until we start drinking. I mean, even the way he dresses, you know, like, that's real Southern.
How so?
I mean, just those long suits, you know? He looks like he's going to an AME church. I don't know if you know the writer K.S.A. Lehman.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
He has a book out called Heavy, which is really something else. And I was talking to him about how Jordan gets a lot of grief for not being Muhammad Ali, right? And so there's something about him to me that feels like this relentless work ethic and will to prove and to escape the gravitational pull of any sort of normal life that anyone might have been expected to lead feels like its own kind of political statement. Seeing him as from this place in the world feels like the key to really seeing him. You know, Kiese was like, what he's told me that's in the story is I can hear it in how his mother calls his father Mr. Jordan. And I actually think Jordan's politics of working hard versus a politics of public critique is rooted in that countryness. If you look at early Jordan and listen to early Jordan, he says, I definitely see a country black boy trying hard to be accepted by the black city of Chicago. You see Michael become the property of the world.
Right. Back in 2013, when you did your last story on Jordan, you spent some time with him. Did you get the sense that he was reflective about all of this? Did he open up about the place that he grew up?
I got the sense that he was becoming acquainted with nostalgia, which was very new for him, and that he was thinking about home and about Mike Jordan and about everything he gained in his improbable journey and, you know, everything he traded for it. He's not giving the jet back or the money back or the rings back. He wouldn't give it back. But I mean, everybody reaches a point in their life where they start to examine the road that brought them there. When Michael goes home to Wilmington, which is rare, he doesn't like to do it really, he goes and sees that house where he grew up, where he has beautiful memories, but also complicated memories. And he remembers what that young person who used to live in that house wanted. And I find that fascinating about him trying to navigate everything that's happened to him. I found him aged in the idea of dealing with the cost of what it had taken him to be Michael Jordan. When he cried, remembering what a jerk he'd been, I think that's what you were seeing, is that someone who would do it again in a second and who doesn't regret it, but who understands that it came at a cost.
The Michael Jordan we just saw in The Last Dance was the fully formed man. But you set out to find the roots of where he came from, his drive, his work ethic, his competitiveness, what that all stemmed from, his family history, the place that he came from. How do you think all of that informs what we just saw?
I think that every piece of it is load-bearing. I think the person we just saw was formed by his very specific combination of where he grew up, where his family lived, how long they lived there, the hopes and dreams of his mother and father, of which he and his siblings are absolutely vessels. And I think the combination of his sense of place, of his desire to be a good steward of what his family had given him, frankly, his desire to not get pulled down by Wilmington, but to leave this place and to fly, sorry for the pun, that all feels really palpable in the man we saw for the last 5 weeks.
Thanks so much, Wright.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Mina. It was fun.
Wright Thompson's full story on Michael Jordan's early history runs on ESPN.com tomorrow. Coming up, imagine for a moment if Jordan hadn't retired from the Bulls. How good would they have been?
Hi, guys. Given everything that is happening in the world right now, most of us are buying things online. I saw that AT&T started doing two really helpful things for those who want to buy a new phone or device online. They are offering fast, free, non-contact delivery and curbside pickup so that online shopping is as simple and safe as possible. On top of that, they have a flexible return policy so you can shop at ease. You can visit att.com to learn how to shop online from the safety of your home 24/7. Subject to change, restrictions apply.
Here's another story I want you to know. Now that The Last Dance has taken its final bow, one pressing question still lingers. Could Michael Jordan and the Bulls have done it again and won another championship in 1999? ESPN senior writer Kevin Pelton attempted to answer this oft-debated hypothetical using advanced stats, so I asked him to come on and tell us about his findings. So Kevin, you decided to not only imagine what would happen if Jordan had never left, but try to quantify it. How did you go about figuring that out?
Yeah, I think it's a fascinating question. So, you know, I went about this two different ways. Number one, kind of looking at coming off of that Last Dance season, what would we have projected for the players on the Bulls going into the what was eventually the post-lockout 98-99 season based on kind of our advanced statistical projections. We got the oldest version of real plus-minus that ESPN Analytics has ever put together, so that was very cool. And then also for everybody but Jordan, you have what they actually did on other teams during that 98-99 season, since, of course, he was the only one who wasn't playing. So, you know, combined those two things because, you know, they were in slightly different roles playing elsewhere.
Since Jordan didn't actually play, how did you go about projecting what his stats would have been that season?
Yeah, that's something that we, you know, do now to try to project what's going to happen in the upcoming season. We put together projections using that real plus minus that generally tend to beat Las Vegas pretty comfortably in terms of the preseason over-unders. So, you know, have some confidence in those. And they actually, you know, the player projection model that I do, which is a little different than that, called Cheney, says that Jordan would have been about the same in 98-99 because, you know, he actually dropped off a little bit more that last season than you would have expected.
Why is it called Cheney?
After Sonics legend Russ Cheney.
Incredible. So you're projecting all these players. Is there anything else that you factored into the analysis? Any sort of statistics you could glean from the season?
Well, I mean, I think one of the big wild cards here is Jordan's health, because when he announced his retirement right after the lockout had ended,
I thought about saying just two words, I'm gone, but I figured I owe the fans and certainly the media a little bit more than that. So that's one of my reasons for being here.
He had this finger injury that ultimately required surgery. He had cut the tendon in the ring finger on his shooting hand in a cigar cutting accident while on vacation. So, you know, that would have been a question mark. But what I kind of posit, because it's more fun as a hypothetical this way, is Jordan said at that press conference he had already made the decision to retire. If he was still planning to play, there's no way he would have been on vacation the week before, you know, the lockout might have ended. He would have been training to get ready.
All right, Kevin. So considering everything, all the data, how the players performed, how they would have performed, the competition, the hypotheticals, all of it, do you think the Bulls would have won again if they had stayed together?
So I think they for sure would have made the NBA finals, because one of the things that, you know, doesn't get discussed during this hypothetical is the East really fell off that lockout shortened season. That was the year that the Knicks ended up making the finals as the eighth seed after dealing with Patrick Ewing's injury during the regular season. And Indiana, which had given them such a tough run in the 98 conference finals, wasn't really the same team in 99 before bouncing back and getting to the finals in 2000. So now, San Antonio then would have presented a really difficult test. They rate better in terms of their regular season point differential than any of the teams the Bulls faced in the six finals they actually did make. So, you know, if you assume that the Bulls were kind of running on fumes by the end of 98 and might have been a little bit more by 99, it would have been by far their toughest obstacle, their toughest challenge. You know, at the same time, is anyone going to bet against Michael Jordan and the Bulls in the finals?
Not after watching this series, no. And I'm also never going to say anything negative about him again.
You don't want him to come find you.
Exactly. Thanks so much, Kevin.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Edie Kimes, and this has been ESPN Daily. If you missed any of our 6 Last Dance-inspired episodes, there's a link in the show description. I'll talk to you tomorrow.